The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Time Magazine. Today's program is supported by G. Suggs Insurance, a SureVest insurance group company. They can be reached at gsuggsinsurance.com. That's gsuggsinsurance.com. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from Time Magazine's edition dated March 9, 2026. The front cover, as usual, features a red border with a narrow white inner border. Time is in large block capital lettering, and it says the people versus AI. There is a montage, I think you would call it, of nine people, none of whom I recognize. Their images are here in color on the cover of Time magazine. Men and women, young to, I would say, middle age in appearance. Various eye color, various skin color, various hair color, various clothing color. It's mostly just the head and shoulders in these photos. Moving on then to the first article, The Brief, Lone Star Preview by Philip Elliott. A wild Texas primary illuminates the dilemma facing both parties. There's a full cover photo here on the first page of the brief. In the background is the tricolor Lone Star flag of the state of Texas. Horizontal stripes in white on the top and red on the bottom. Then off to the left, a vertical column of blue with one white star upon it. That's in color, but in the foreground are five figures in black and white photograph superimposed upon the flag. One woman of color, the rest are men of color and Caucasian. It looks like various ages, from a young-looking person to a person with white hair. In terms of the men, the men are all wearing suits, light-colored shirts, and ties. Turning the page to the one-page article. This is the brief opener. No other candidate on the ballot this year made a bigger splash simply by entering a race than Ken Paxton. The firebrand Texas Attorney General and Donald Trump booster is giving U.S. Senator John Cornyn a serious threat in the GOP primary, which in turn has launched an increasingly nasty fight among Democrats who view Paxton as beatable. Now, with early voting for the March 3 primary underway, I am reading this, by the way, the day before the primary. It is not just the mudslinging that has insiders in both parties watching with high anxiety. The dynamics in this race may well propel the entire election cycle and the next. For Senate Republicans, Texas was not supposed to be a problem child this year. The state has not elected a Democrat to statewide office in over three decades, since 1994. Cornyn, a sharp Paul who is a holdover from the George W. Bush era, was widely expected to cruise to a fifth term this November. But along the way, the race has turned into a political dilemma for both sides. The fulcrum for the chaos is Paxton, a polarizing figure whose potential strength among MAGA diehards triggered Cornyn's allies to dump $50 million and counting on ads to prop up the incumbent. Polling from the University of Houston conducted at the end of January showed Paxton leading by 7 points with 38% of the vote, followed by Cornyn at 31% and a third candidate, U.S. Representative Wesley Hunt, drawing 17% support. Cornyn, who was once seen as the heir to epic Senate leader Mitch McConnell, now finds himself in the political fight of his life. Across the aisle, the prospect of Paxton's winning the GOP nomination has galvanized Democrats, who face a head-versus-heart choice between two rising liberal stars. Representative Jasmine Crockett has emerged as one of her party's fiercest messengers, a sharp-tongued partisan who makes few apologies for pluck. For instance, when Attorney General Pam Bondi appeared at an overnight hearing on February 11, Crockett used her time to berate the nation's top cop and stormed out of the hearing room when Bondi returned fire. State Representative James Tallarico, meanwhile, is a head-down pragmatist who speaks eloquently about his Christian faith and has drawn an impressive national following of his own. It is as if AOC and Mayor Pete were on a collision course for the same prize. Just as polls show Paxton in the lead among Republicans, Crockett is pacing ahead of Tallarico by 8 points. All of which explains why this election is about more than representing the Lone Star State. At a moment of maximum tension in both parties over political purity tests, identity politics, and the political power of Trumpism, the Texas race has become the ultimate petri dish for the biggest questions in electoral politics since 2026. Ultimately, both parties face the same dilemma. The candidate on track to win their primary is seen as less competitive in November. For Democrats, the Texas intra-party squabble has exposed a raw nerve over the party's path forward. Crockett, 44, and Tallarico, 36, are both digital natives who know how to get their messages out, even if they are at times in conflict. For months, the primary was shuffling along amiably between Tallarico and former Representative Colin Allred, a retired NFL player. Things quickly grew more contentious in December when Crockett decided to jump in, prompting Allred to forego his Senate bid in order to vie for the seat Crockett is vacating. Tallarico, meanwhile, has built strong national buzz with an unexpected media tour that laced progressive politics with religious values in a way few have landed before. Things got dicey in early February when a TikTok influencer said Tallarico had called Allred a mediocre black man. Allred replied with fire, throwing his support to Crockett. Tallarico described the whole incident as a mischaracterization of a private conversation. But the bell cannot be unrung. On the GOP side, Republicans face a three-way jumble that was not expected even last fall. Over 20 years, Cornyn has built a machine of campaign vets and deep-pocketed donors. Paxton, a right-winger who has cast himself as a steady ally of Trump's, has a long list of scandals to his name that keep resurfacing. Further adding to the drama is January's special election for the Texas legislature, which yielded a 31-point swing away from Republicans, prompting some to forecast a massive Democratic wave looming. As Cornyn, Paxton, and Hunt jockey for votes, the ever-unpredictable Trump is lurking. Trump has hedged on an endorsement, saying all three candidates are pals. For Republicans, it is a question of the establishment versus MAGA's eclipsing power. For Democrats, it is a choice between a resistance champion and someone who can woo the center. Is there a better frame for 2028? For now, Paxton is the driving force in both parties in Texas, and in a way, even nationally. If Democrats are going to capture the Senate, they need to figure out who is best suited to defeat the GOP nominee. If Republicans want to defend their majority, they have to decide if they are invested in a Paxton or Hunt for Cornyn swap. It is a conversation about electability that is seldom this out in the open. On top, there's about a half-page photograph. It's blurry. Supposedly, it is intentional. I don't see a photo credit here. Lots of horizontal colorations, almost like a rainbow spectrum, but not quite. And at the bottom, in the foreground, on almost a sea of blue, two blurry figures. One is male, dressed in black. One is female, dressed in silver, being held, it looks like, in a pirouette on the male's shoulders. On top is the caption, Japanese figure skaters Riku Miura and Ryuichi Kohara compete in the pairs skating free program February 16, the 10th day of the 2026 Winter Olympics in Milan. Despite entering the finals in fifth place, the two won gold, the first medal in pair skating for their home country. Duos from Georgia and Germany earned silver and bronze medals, respectively. Then at the bottom of the page, the bulletin, sentencing of Hong Kong publisher raises fears in Taiwan. This is by Chad de Guzman. When a Hong Kong court handed media tycoon and pro-democracy leader Jimmy Lai, or Lai, that's L-A-I, a 20-year jail term on national security grounds February 9, his son called it a death sentence, given Lai's age, 78, and deteriorating health. Others saw the same bleak implications for freedoms in Hong Kong and a glimpse into what could be in store for others, Beijing views as troublesome. The one country, two systems principle governing Hong Kong was actually designed with Taiwan in mind. Former Chinese leader Deng Xiaoping advanced the framework as a way for Taiwan to peacefully reunite with the mainland while respecting the realities and the existing system there. In a bid to make the principle more palatable to Taiwan's government, China applied it to Hong Kong and Macau after the British and the Portuguese territories were ceded back to China in the late 1990s, allowing the so-called special administrative regions to operate with their own economic systems and governments. But pro-democracy figures despair, noting that local governance in Hong Kong has grown increasingly aligned with the mainland, as political dissidents have either been jailed or exiled, organizations disbanded, and a free press dismantled. Steve Song, director of the SOAS China Institute in London, said that Lai's sentence would affirm to the watching Taiwanese government and its people that one country, two systems is a future they cannot accept. Observers saw an example. I believe the way that China is treating Hong Kong is the way it wants to treat Taiwan next and beyond that other countries, Mark Clifford, president of the Committee for Freedom in Hong Kong Foundation in the U.S., said before Lai's sentencing. After court adjourned, a spokesperson for Human Rights Watch stated, "Today is Hong Kong, tomorrow Taiwan." The brief news. Good question. How will we take the news of alien life? By Jeffrey Kluger. There's one inset photograph here. It is in color. The colors are dim and dull and darkly. The center of the Hart Nebula, located in the Perseus arm of our galaxy. It looks nebulous. Dark blues, dark purples, a few bright spots as if they are stars or planets. Deep bronze, deep gold, greens like aquamarine, spring grass green, and then into more browns and golds and bronze colors, and back up to the spectrum of the purples and blues and grays. Looking forward to the discovery of life in space. Maybe you should think twice. We are an emotional, not always rational species, and scientists, political leaders, and the media have long wondered just how to break the news that ET has been found to a public that could respond with excitement, fear, suspicion, skepticism, or a whole range of other positive or problematic reactions. In 2024, NASA took up the matter, convening a virtual astrobiology workshop called Communicating Discoveries in the Search for Life in the Universe. Over 100 experts, including journalists, astrobiologists, social scientists, and communicators, attended the workshop online. Recently, a number of them published a paper in the journal Astrobiology, exploring the workshop's findings, and the stakes could not be higher. The search for life in space is not just a science question, says Brian Soldowski, associate professor in the Department of Communications at Portland State University, and a co-author of the paper. It's a moral question. It's a philosophical question. For some, it's a religious question. This has deep implications for our understanding of what it means to be human. Extraterrestrial life can be discovered in one of two forms. Alien biology, or more sensationally, alien technology. Much has been made in recent years of footage captured by naval pilots of what appear to be flying objects, diving, turning, hovering, in ways no known aircraft can manage. According to a 2021 survey by the Pew Research Center, 51% of respondents believe the objects are of extraterrestrial origin. Fully 87% reported if the craft are indeed alien, they pose no threat to Earth. Definitive proof that aliens move among us, one of those objects landing on a naval runway, say, could stir up an entirely different set of reactions, especially fear. That is where communicators could come in. We saw this in COVID, says Soldowski. When you're communicating about a risk, it is important to communicate what we know, and more importantly, what we do not know, and the steps that are being taken to protect the public interest. Finding microbial life on another world will be a different matter. The journal paper says communicators need to prepare the public to see traces from faraway places before they see faces. Since only a tiny share of people will ever read the published papers that report the finding, it will be up to journalists to convey the news, and Soldowski worries about how well that job will be done. We hardly have science journalists anymore, she says. We have generalists who sometimes cover science. The challenge is amplified by media trends that often favor concise, exciting narratives over detailed explanations of ambiguity, the paper says. One way to combat that is to educate the public in advance, providing a steady stream of news releases even before research begins, explaining the science in simple descriptive language. This allows scientists to familiarize lay audiences with the work they are doing and to pre-bunk or proactively correct misconceptions and rumors. For that, the paper recommends a full-time communications professional be affiliated with any research team. In a universe with many trillions of planets, there are surely non-zero odds that at least some of them can cook up something living. There are non-zero odds, too, that earthly scientists will one day spot that life. Just as they are working to make that discovery, the public must work to understand it when it comes. To the milestones page, or rather pages, it's a page and a column, there are three items, all articles for those who have died. There are a few items on the bottom. I'll read those first today. Released, a hymn to life. Shame has to change sides. A memoir by sexual assault survivor Giselle Pellico, February 17, in nearly two dozen languages. Inaugurated Tariq Rahman as Bangladesh's Prime Minister, February 17, after the first parliamentary election since the 2024 uprising, announced by Anderson Cooper that he's leaving CBS's 60 Minutes to spend more time with his family. He will continue anchoring on CNN. Revealed that Alexei Navalny was likely poisoned by a toxin sourced from poison dart frogs, five European nations said February 14. Arrested, former Prince Andrew Mountbatten Windsor, February 19, over his ties to Jeffrey Epstein while in public office. Now to the first of the deaths being reported. Jesse Jackson, civil rights icon, written by Olivia Ann Cleary and Callum Sutherland. Jesse Jackson was enrolled at the Chicago Theological Seminary in 1965 when he decided to join other like-minded students in traveling to Selma, Alabama, where Martin Luther King Jr. was leading a march to the state capitol in Montgomery. The march became an enduring touch point in American civil rights history, as did Jackson, who struck up a friendship with King and eventually became a protege. When King relocated to Chicago in 1966 to launch a new branch of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, he enlisted Jackson to work on the group's economic justice program, dubbed Operation Breadbasket. Jackson was with King before his assassination in April 1968, and months later was ordained as a Baptist minister, vowing to continue King's fight to achieve equality for African Americans. Our father was a servant leader, not only to our family, but to the oppressed, the voiceless, and the overlooked around the world, his relatives said, announcing Jackson died February 17 at 84. The Rainbow Push Coalition, a Chicago-based nonprofit he founded, said he'd been living for over a decade with progressive supranuclear palsy, a neurodegenerative condition. Jackson, always a voice for voting rights and registration, campaigned for the Democratic presidential nomination in 1984 and 1988. We stood on his shoulders, said former President Barack Obama and First Lady Michelle. His charisma traveled well. Jackson preached empowerment, I am somebody. in the same pulpit cadences with which in 1991 he recited Green Eggs and Ham on Saturday Night Live. In 2000, he was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom by President Bill Clinton. The cause of justice, said Clinton, has no greater co-worker than Jesse Jackson. Here's a column off to the right. Died James Van Der Beek, teen heartthrob, written by Chad de Guzman. James Van Der Beek, best known for playing Dawson Leary in the 90s teen drama Dawson's Creek, passed peacefully, his family said, February 11, at age 48, after a battle with colorectal cancer. Dawson's Creek, which premiered in 1998 and ran for six seasons, was considered a pioneer in American teen television and helped cement Van Der Beek's status as a pop culture icon. From 2012 to 2013, he played a fictionalized version of himself on the ABC sitcom Don't Trust the Bee, in Apartment 23, and later he appeared on the reality show Dancing with the Stars. His family reportedly received over $1 million in donations to support them after Van Der Beek's treatment costs took a toll on their finances. And one more column reporting a death, Robert Duvall, actor of distinction, by Stephanie Zakarik. There's a small inset photo here of Duvall. It's in color, but it's really in black and beige tones. Duvall here has very little hair on his head. Apparently, it's light brown. His head is almost bald, and that's where the skin tone or the beige comes in. He's wearing a black jacket, it appears. It's just a headshot with a brown background, and he's smiling obliquely. Some actors melt into their roles. But Robert Duvall, who died February 15 at age 95, did not. Not quite. He was too much of a presence for that. From the silky smooth fixer Tom Hagen, in the first two Godfather movies, 1972 and 1974, to Lieutenant Colonel Kilgore, the outlandish lover of Wagner, and Surfing in Apocalypse Now, 1979, to the true believer and redemption seeker Sonny in The Apostle, 1997, which he also wrote and directed, Duvall had a live wire crackle, distinctly his own. His eyes could be steely. They could also dance with light and joy. He played plenty of memorable jerks, like the supercilious surgeon Frank Burns in Robert Altman's MASH, 1970, or the slash-and-burn TV executive Frank Hackett in Network, 1976. The characters he played were not always likable or trustworthy, but he seduced us into believing in them. That was his gift. He did not so much shift shape as shift something in us, opening us up to human complexities and contradictions that made the world seem bigger, not smaller. Stephanie Zakarik wrote that column. I remember him first as Boo, the shadowy figure in To Kill a Mockingbird. Turning the page now to the brief health. Why You Should Warm Up Your Feet Before Bed by Angela Haupt. Getting cold feet is inconvenient in many situations, including when you go to bed. Our body temperature leads our sleep cycle, says Kenneth Diller, a professor of biomedical engineering at the University of Texas at Austin, who has researched thermoregulation Your body does best when the central area is cooler and the peripheral is warmer. Decades of research suggests people with warm hands and feet fall asleep faster than those whose extremities are cold. Here is why, plus the best ways to put it into practice. When you are getting ready for sleep, your body needs to cool down to signal it's time to rest. Ironically, warming your hands and feet helps that happen because your body uses them as heat release zones, Diller says. When your extremities are warm, blood flows more easily to the skin, allowing excess heat from your core to escape. As your core temperature drops, your brain gets the message, it's time to fall asleep. If your hands and feet stay cold, however, that heat cannot escape as well, making it harder to drift off. Warming up your hands and feet leads your body very effectively into sleep, Diller says. Otherwise, you just lie there feeling miserable. Years ago, Diller's wife came up with a rule. There was an absolute law within our family that when I have icicle hands and feet, there's a virtual impenetrable barrier between the two sides of our bed, he says. Fortunately, you can warm up your hands and feet before going to bed in a variety of ways. One of the most obvious, taking a hot shower or bath. Diller usually works out in the evening, then jumps in the shower. At the end, he cranks the temperature up to where initially it's a little bit painful, but you get used to it, he says. Do not, however, exceed 111 degrees Fahrenheit, which he points out is the threshold for thermal injury. The way skin gets red in a hot shower is actually a signal that blood is traveling to the specialized vessels in the hands and feet that open wide to release heat. Diller also enjoys heating pads, though it's safest to turn them off before you fall asleep. One night, as he was investigating which heating techniques worked best, he slipped one underneath his pillow. When he and his wife turned in, they read for a while as he heated up the area overlying his cervical spine, which helps control the body's temperature. It's like holding a match under the thermostat. It changes the operation of your thermal regulation, he says. Remarkably, my hands and feet very quickly, in short minutes, were toasty warm. Of course, if you do not feel like overly complicating your bedtime routine, you can simply slip on your favorite fuzzy socks or slippers. No matter how you approach it, the goal is to remove one of the body's biggest barriers to sleep. Cold hands and feet keep the nervous system on alert. Warmth helps it stand down. As long as I've got cold hands and feet, Diller says, I'm not going to be doing a good job of falling asleep. Well, here's eight questions. This appears at the end of the magazine, so I'm skipping ahead. Eight questions in question-answer format. Sean Gregory has written this column. It's Breezy Johnson, the U.S. skier, on winning Olympic gold, that mountain marriage proposal, and Lindsey Vonn's example. Question, you've never won a tour race, but have Olympic and world titles. Why are you big game Breezy? Answer, everything has so many variables that all have to come together. They finally did, and hopefully we can take that ball rolling and show that big game Breezy can be small game Breezy in the next World Cup. Question, after your Super G race, February 12, your boyfriend Connor Watkins proposed at the bottom of the slope. Were you surprised? Answer, you don't get engaged to somebody in front of the whole world. at the Olympics without them telling you a little bit. When we started getting really serious, I was like, I always had kind of this concept of getting engaged at the Olympics. In the end, the Italian president almost ruined the whole thing. He was coming down to the stadium, and then it was like, well, you can't move. The Italian president's moving. Question, you met on Bumble. He did not know you were a professional ski racer. Was that a good thing? Answer, we started talking. Then it's like, well, what do you do? And I was like, oh, I'm a skier. And then he goes, oh, are you a ski instructor? No, for the U.S. team. At that point, people's eyes kind of turn into big washers. They're like, oh, my God. But he was good about it. Question, Atkins also gave you a piece of wood carved with words from Taylor Swift's song, The Alchemy. Then Swift congratulated you on Instagram. What was your reaction? Answer, incredible. I never expected that. We started dating at a similar time as she and Travis Kelce. Then The Alchemy came out. We were just moving in together at that point. It's one of our favorites. Question, during your winning downhill run, February 8, are you thinking, I can feel my speed and know I can win this thing? Answer, you feel the speed. I also knew that I was a little bit wild in certain places. I got a little bit twisted up. I knew that there's still terrain all the way to the finish. It was not going to matter that I skied the top well. Once I came across the line, I saw the time, and I was like, I think that's for sure good enough for a medal, and it might be gold. I was definitely pretty psyched. Question, you were in the leader's chair when Lindsey Vonn crashed. What was that experience like? Answer, I watched her go into that uphill double, and she was really clean and charging. And I was like, oh, SH space T, this could be a good run. And then it was immediately over. There's a speaker. I thought I could hear her screaming in pain. That's just never something you want as a human being or as a teammate or a friend. That was hard to hear. Question, you sat out the 2024-25 season because of a suspension for 3 missed drug tests. You've attributed the whereabouts violations to human error and said you've never intentionally dodged a test. Do you think this performance erases all questions about what happened? Answer, that's more for other people to decide. I made an excellent comeback from everything. I was still having anxiety attacks right after the downhill. That, because I won Olympic gold, people from the World Anti-Doping Agency were going to see that and be like, there's no way. We have to figure out how to ban her again. I'm just grateful to have so many impressive results and things for people to be proud of in front of that suspension. Last question, how long do you plan on skiing? Answer, I have no plans of stopping. Lindsey showed people can do it a lot longer than anybody thought. I definitely would love to do at least another quad. Obviously, the 2034 Salt Lake Olympics would be crazy. I have my little cat family. I don't have any baby fever yet. The cat family is very fulfilling to me. Time Off Reviews Television by Judy Berman. If the Kennedys are the closest thing America has to a royal family, then Carolyn Bessette Kennedy was our Princess Diana. Like her British counterpart, she was an outsider, albeit a beautiful, stylish, blonde, privileged one, to the palace intrigue that consumed the family she married into. She was stalked by paparazzi and alternately worshipped and vilified, and then she died in her mid-30s in a horrible accident, only to have her legacy dissected for decades to come, we never let either woman rest in peace. These parallels are not lost on the makers of FX's Love Story, John F. Kennedy Jr. and Carolyn Bessette, the first season of Ryan Murphy's real-life romance anthology, created by Connor Hines and adapted from Elizabeth Beller's 2024 biography. The show adheres to what might be called Ryan Murphy's law. Every morsel of subtext must be converted into text. As soon as you think, wow, they're really giving Carolyn the Diana treatment, characters start saying things like, you're going to be the American people's princess. This results in a fusion of The Crown's later seasons and a Murphyverse obsessed with reframing 20th century American mythology. A story with many strong elements, but that does not dig deep enough. Like Beller's book, JFK Jr. and Carolyn Bessette is a revisionist project that makes Carolyn its protagonist. Love Story nails the casting with Sarah Pidgeon, a Tony-nominated actor with a few TV and film credits, who's still a fresh face to viewers, as Bessette was to the world. Far from a tabloid caricature, Pidgeon's Carolyn is a model of intelligence, poise, and ambition, a no-nonsense career woman rising in the world of fashion. She seems at once averse to the spotlight and playing a savvy romantic long game. The Kennedys are less enthralling. Newcomer Paul Anthony Kelly looks like the tall, dark, and dashing John Jr. and does a fine job as the son and likely unable, the son unwilling and likely unable to equal a father he barely knew. Naomi Watts gives an uncharacteristically broad performance as Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis, chafing at her America's Widow identity. Amid a mass of indistinguishable cousins, the one memorable portrayal is Grace Gummer as John's older sister Caroline, still playing surrogate parent to the overgrown boy she cared for while their mother lost herself in grief. The costumes, 90s New York production design, and overall mise-en-scène are so immersive and Pidgeon's Carolyn so compelling, I often forgot the story itself was slow and repetitive. We see a lot of false starts to a relationship whose chemistry could be more vividly conveyed. Also a lot of Crown-style lamentation about the media vultures who have been pecking at the Kennedys for generations. The real tragedy we are made to understand is that Carolyn thinks she understands what she's getting into. But once the couple returns after a troubled wedding, the feeding frenzy is many degrees of magnitude worse. It turns this capable woman into a shut-in who's too much of a distraction to work in the industry she loves. It is ironic that marrying John destroys the very independence that made her so attractive to him, but that is not enough to hang 8 episodes on. The experience that The Crown depicts and JFK Jr. and Carolyn Bessette echoes is that of the ultimate gilded cage. What perpetual scrutiny does to a family that prioritizes appearances over relationships? But there should be room for other ideas. For all its flaws, The Crown asked bigger questions. Love Story shows no interest in understanding what the Kennedys meant to a nation that prided itself on having no kings, but elevated this particular dynasty as a surrogate royal family. That is a shame, especially as its heirs continue to drive American politics from the far right to the young left. If the people we put on pedestals are mirrors for society, what did the Kennedys say about us in the 1960s, the 90s today. Again, television. The 30 Rock team's sporty comeback is a touchdown. No credit to the writer here. Oh, JB, Judy Berman. The best way to spend a Thursday night, circa 2010, was to park yourself in front of an NBC comedy lineup that featured The Office, 30 Rock, Parks and Recreation, and Community. All four shows have since become classics, but some have had more influence on the network sitcom landscape, one that has never been the same since they ended, than others. The Office and its direct descendant, Parks and Rec, gave rise to a generation of sweet, faintly progressive mockumentaries. Modern Family, Abbott Elementary, St. Denis Medical. Last year, Peacock unveiled a confoundingly dated Office spinoff, The Paper. Having always preferred the darker, more manic and referential humor of 30 Rock and Community, I have found the relative scarcity of that style disappointing. So, I am extra delighted to report that the fall and rise of Reggie Dinkins, an NBC sitcom airing on Mondays that stars Tracy Morgan and is co-created by Robert Carlock, a longtime collaborator of executive producer Tina Fey, is network TV's first worthy heir to 30 Rock. What that show was to SNL, this one is to the NFL. The surprise is that it also smartly cribs from The Office's playbook. One key ingredient of any Fey World comedy is a cast of characters that balances incongruous, frequently delusional personalities, neurotics, fools, cynics, innocence. Morgan in the title role of a football star, desperate to redeem himself 2 decades after he accidentally confessed on live TV that he had gambled on his own game, plays a more tender athlete version of his wild card 30 Rock comedian. Too ashamed to show his face in public, Reggie putters around a mansion that shrewd business decisions by his manager, agent, and ex, Monica, the great Erica Alexander in Living Single Mode, have allowed him to hang on to. The former spouse's co-parent and ingenuous teen, Carmelo, Jalen Hall. Rounding out this non-traditional family are Reggie's younger, aspiring musician fiancé, Brina, Precious Way, and basement-dwelling best buddy Bobby Moynihan's Rusty, a goofy NFL never was. In hopes of repairing his reputation, Reggie hires an Oscar-winning filmmaker, Daniel Radcliffe's Arthur Tobin, to direct a flattering doc about him. But Tobin is too principled to make an infomercial. Monica doubts his highbrow Brit is capable of understanding Reggie's rags-to-riches-to-infamy tale. In fact, Tobin knows as well as anyone what it's like to commit career suicide. A hilarious Faux's amateur video shows him melting down on the set of a Marvel movie. Everyone in this story could use a fresh start. Reggie Dinkins is more or less a mockumentary, albeit one that adds a layer of self-awareness by putting the director inside the frame. It also shares with the Parks and Rec cohort a lovable cast of characters. There are fun villains. Reggie's nemesis is a sneakily vicious NFL alum, Craig Robinson, with the splendid name Jerry Basmati. But on Team Reggie, there is no ruthless Jack Donaghy, no narcissistic Jenna Maroney. Maybe that's a canny concession to the present, when real-life monsters make it harder to laugh along with monstrous characters. Fay and Carlock's Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, a black comedy about a woman recovering from years of abuse at the hands of a cult leader captor, is not exactly topping my 2026 rewatch list. For the most part, though, their hyper style has aged well. Quick cutaways to vertical videos or schlocky ads or a panel show called Sports Shouting echo our screen-mediated reality. Pop culture geekery remains the lingua franca of Fey World. Diving down rabbit holes on Russell Crowe's band and the Korean radical feminist movement 4B. Reggie's favorite procedural is called FDNY Chicago, solemn narrator. In the New York Fire Department, there is a special unit that fights fires in Chicago. The unhinged brilliance of a peak-era 30 Rock might be impossible to recreate, but in its first season, Reggie Dinkins already qualifies as a hell of a comeback. In the Loop by Billy Perigo, tech correspondent. For 15 years, Dex Hunter Torecki worked near the pinnacle of the tech industry. He wrote speeches for Mark Zuckerberg, handled crises for Elon Musk, and most recently headed up PR at Google DeepMind, where he spun optimistic stories about how AI was leading the world toward a better future. Now he tells Time he only told half the story. AI, he now says, will likely lead to mass job losses and geopolitical upheaval within the next decade. Tech leaders lobbied against major regulations and argued publicly that AI will unlock medical discoveries, empower individuals, and boost economic growth. But Hunter Torecki, who helped engineer those narratives, says the industry downplays the chances that AI will erode democracy, increase economic inequality, and inflame international conflict. We're sleepwalking into disaster, he says, criticizing his former bosses for having no coherent strategy for dealing with those problems. There is no plan. I do not believe for a second that winging it through the biggest economic and technological transition is a responsible way to do things. Tech executives don't defect very often, so it is worth listening to them when they do. But after remaining silent about his concerns for years, Hunter Torecki is choosing to share them at an opportune time. The launch of his own nonprofit, which he says will address the problems he is worried about. A Google spokesperson contested his argument, saying, "The company has always told a balanced story about AI that takes both its risks and benefits into account." The People vs. AI behind the cover. Time sent photographer Benedict Evans across the nation to make portraits of citizens taking a stand against AI. At every stop, usually a home or office, Evans meticulously measured the distance between the backdrop, chair, and lighting, replicating the arrangement to lend the series a quiet cohesion. In an era when artificial intelligence is swiftly being embedded into the fabric of work, this photo shoot was intended to portray an uncompromising salute to human authorship. I am deeply skeptical of artificial intelligence, so I found it fascinating to travel the country and discuss our future with people who, for each of their different reasons, have made opposition to it central to their lives, Evans says. And here are the people that populate the front cover of Time: Michael Grayston, Hannah Drummond, Francesca Hong, Alicia Johnson, Joe Allen, Jordan Harmon, Mackenzie Roberts, John Polowich, Justine Bateman. The photographs are by Benedict Evans for Time. It was a 2-week solo trip, he says, with quite a punishing schedule. 10 U.S. cities in 14 days, as was the physical heavy lifting that goes with carrying a mobile studio setup across the country single-handedly. But the portrait sittings themselves provided the calmer, human moments of connection along the way. Traveling alone is a potent reminder of the value of authentic connection with others, something I think we can only have with other living beings. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine, which is generously supported by G. Suggs Insurance, a SureVest insurance group company. They can be reached at gsuggsinsurance.com. We hope you enjoyed listening. Please join us next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.